Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pop Health Podcast. My name is Gavin Ward, and I'm the host of Pop Health Podcast. And today we are with the best storyteller in Long Beach, and we're going to tell you a little bit more about this gentleman here in a moment. Ryan Iwamoto is joining me as well today as my co-host. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you, Gavin. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And I believe, Ryan, this is your second or third episode hosting. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Very good. So most people are probably tuning in to find out who our guest is and what he has to say. We are with the very well-known Dr. Bob Slay. Dr. Bob Slay is a resident of Southern California in the LA area, and he has quite a long resume. And so I'm going to share with you a little bit about Dr. Bob and his resume. Dr. Bob is a practicing emergency physician with Providence Health and Services, and he's board certified in emergency medicine and internal medicine. Dr. Slay is also a fellow Dr. Slay is a fellow of the American College of Emergency Medicine and the American Academy of Emergency Medicine. He's also a board examiner for the American Board of Emergency Medicine. He served as a consultant in emergency medicine to the Surgeon General. He served internationally as a consultant, and he's also published numerous textbooks in emergency medicine. One of the really exciting stories from Dr. Bob's past is he's a retired decorated colonel from the U.S. Army Medical Corps, where he served as a physician member of the elite anti-terrorist Delta Force during the Desert One hostage that many of you may remember was a hostage rescue attempt in Iran. He has written for and acted in several national television shows, including multiple appearances. I think it's about 12. Is that correct, Dr. Bob?
That's correct.
For Untold Stories of the ER, and actually three episodes of one that might get your attention, Sex Sent Me to the ER. Dr. Slay also does medical stand-up ER comedy as a hobby under Funny ER Doctor, and you can learn more about that on YouTube. And actually, Dr. Bob, as I mentioned earlier, was recently named the best storyteller in Long Beach. And lastly, Dr. Bob is an author of the best-selling book, The Battle Buddy Diet. Dr. Bob, thanks so much for joining us today.
It is a pleasure to be here.
So, Dr. Bob, can you tell us a little bit about your past and how in the world you even got involved to become a physician?
Well, you know, becoming a physician was kind of a done deal in my family. My mother's side of the family, they had lots and lots of doctors, and I was kind of aimed in that direction. And then after graduating college from the Virginia Military Institute, I was given a choice. There was a conflict called Vietnam, and they said, you're being commissioned in the Army, and you may either go to medical school or join your unit in the Armored Division heading to Vietnam. Which would you like to do? And I said, you know, can I think about, you know what, I am going to become a doctor. I'll go to medical school. So I actually went to medical school on a scholarship.
Nice.
With the Army, and never looked back. It's been a wonderful career, and I love it.
And then how did you get into emergency medicine?
Well, you know, in training, I actually trained as an internal medicine specialist. And I found out that when you train as an internal medicine specialist, you have these wonderful rotations in your training where you go to the GI ward and you get to do endoscopies and liver biopsies. You rotate through cardiology. You get to do pacemakers and go in the cardiac cath lab and all kinds of exciting things. But when you become an internist, that's a doctor who really has no specialty but takes care of everything, and you get to do nothing. You sit in an office, you see one patient after the other with incurable disease who are non-compliant, self-destructive, diabetes, hypertension, lung disease. That's 80%, 90% of what you're going to see, and you sit there and write prescriptions all day long. That's what it's all about. That is boring and frustrating. So I got a rotation in the ER, and I found out that, and I do have a little ADD, so I'm up on my feet, I'm running around, I'm getting to do a little of this, a little of that. There's a real eclectic mix there of problems.
Oh, I'm sure.
Nothing the same every day, and that just immediately attracted me. So that's what I wanted to end up doing. So that's what I ended up doing.
And how many years have you been doing emergency medicine, Dr. Slayer, Dr. Bob?
It's pretty scary, but it's going to be going on about 38 years. I've been board certified for 32 years in emergency medicine. So it was really nice when they came along with that penicillin back early in my career. You know, before then it was kind of tough in medicine, but that was really nice. I've been doing it a long time.
Tell us a story. You've spent some time with the military. Tell us about maybe an experience then that maybe the hostage rescue attempt, maybe something that folks may want to hear more details about.
Well, you know, that was to me a very disappointing mark in the history of the United States, because we had 52 people that were taken hostage in Iran. They were in the American embassy. I was with the Delta Force. The Delta Force actually had something like 20-some people on the ground in Tehran at the time, already setting up for the rescue attempt. They had two or three people working for us in the embassy with the, quote, terrorist. So we knew everything about that place. We knew every single room. We had done practices on mock embassies in the desert. We knew everything about the schedule, which prisoner was in which room, who was taking care of them. Everything was completely laid out. There was a 9-foot wall we had to go over to get in there. The helicopters flew out. They were going to load the team into trucks, hide in the mountains. The next morning, come go over the wall, take it, secure the soccer field, fly the helicopters in, bring everybody out. Perfect plan, yeah. Perfect information, intel. And it failed because of the mishap and the explosion in the desert. That was tense. As the sergeant used to tell me, and I would have a 45 with no ammunition. The doctor was never given ammunition because we don't want him sitting there fiddling around with his weapon and shoot himself in the foot or something. So I used to ask the sergeant, well, when do I get my ammunition? And he told me one time, sir, if we give you ammunition, it means it's every man for himself.
Yeah.
And so when the stuff blew up in the desert, I was issued ammunition. And I thought, oh, boy, this is it. We thought it was a rocket attack or something. So it was very depressing. As we flew back after the debacle in the desert, the operators, there were 100 Delta people, were just sitting there. And I remember the tears going down their face over their camouflage because they were so disappointed they didn't get in there and do their thing. So it was a very, very sad situation. People were killed, and it was just a real, real failure.
Well, we really appreciate you sharing those details. I know my whole family is pretty much military, and my mom actually lived in Iran for a little bit, so that story has some impact on me, and I'm sure some of our listeners as well. Getting more to the business side of things, Dr. Slay, can you tell us a little bit about what you're currently doing, where you're currently working, and let's go from there.
I'm right now working as an emergency staff physician at Providence Hospital Systems, little company of Mary Torrance. It's a pretty big hospital, around 400 beds, very, very busy emergency department, seeing anywhere from 150 to almost 200 people a day. Very busy place, and excellent, outstanding physicians, outstanding support staff. I think named one of the top 100 hospitals 4 years in a row in the nation. I think for a community hospital, it's the top of the line. I'm flattered to be able to work there.
That's great. That place has a special place in my heart. I was actually born there X amount of years ago. At the time, it was just called, I believe, Little Company of Mary. There wasn't an affiliation with Providence at the time. But Little Company Mary Torrance definitely plays a special place in my heart. And I know our company actually, Ryan, started in Torrance, correct?
Yeah, started just right down the street off of Hawthorne and Sepulveda, just a few blocks away.
So, Dr. Slay, one thing I wanted to ask you previously is, what's something about you people wouldn't know necessarily?
I think the fact that I like to do stand-up comedy in the ER with the patients, I think making that connection with a patient in the ER is absolutely critical, winning their trust. And I'm not saying we go in and make light when somebody's in the dire straits or something. But, for example, the poor guy that comes in with his hand cut from trying to slice bagels on Sunday morning, I can tell him, I've been there, I've done that, I know exactly what you're talking about. Be careful about those frozen hamburgers and separating them with the sharp knife, because I've also been on the table for that.
It's funny you brought that up, because that has happened to me as well. I've gone to the ER for slicing Frozen bagels.
Yeah. The frozen ones are particularly tricky.
Yeah.
We call that the Sunday morning bagel check-in, and we see 2 to 3 people. They have a thing called a bagel slicer, actually.
Worth its weight in gold, yeah.
Yeah, which I figured out later. So I'll make some jokes. If you come in with a red eye and you're the right kind of guy, I might say, gee, Gavin, you got that red eye from looking for love in all the wrong places.
Ooh.
Or something like that.
Funny stuff.
So, Dr. Bob, I know you've told some great stories, and I think you recently won an award for Best Storyteller in Long Beach. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Can you tell me, all right, you put yourself on the spot. Is there a story that kind of won you the award or a story that sort of sticks out that you can share with our audience?
Well, the actual story that won was called The Naked Man Running. And what happened was I came to work one Saturday afternoon and entered the ER through the ambulance entrance, the big kind of opening doors there, hit the little pressure plate, the doors opened behind me, or opened in front of me. I walked through, and as I walked into the hall of the ambulance entrance, in the back part of the ER, there was a huge commotion, and people screaming and doors opening and slamming, and all of a sudden, a naked man popped out of the room that we called the psych restrain room. And I noticed right away that this man had a mullet haircut. He was kind of thin. He had total body tattoos. And he had kind of an odor that whiffed through the entire ER. And he looked a little wild-eyed, and he was running directly toward me. I then noticed that he also had a Foley catheter in place, coming from the penis and hanging to a bag half full of urine, flapping in the breeze as he ran toward me.
What a great visual.
Exactly.
Completely and the nurses, naked here.
Completely naked. And the nurses all screamed, "Stop him! Stop him, Dr. Slay! Stop him!" Now, I took an oath in medical school to keep people from harm and so forth, and this man is obviously having some delusional situations here, and I need to stop him before he runs out of the ER and harms himself or runs in front of a bus or something, so I am going to tackle him. Now, I played a little football in high school, a little free safety, a little cornerback. I can bring a man down in the open field.
Of course.
I am in my scrub suit with tennis shoes on, seeing him approach, and I know that this guy is going down. I will tackle him. So I'm ready. I'm squaring up my shoulders. I'm getting on my toes. I'm getting down low. I'm getting ready to come in there. And as all of your audience knows who played football, when you tackle a guy who's going to try to run by you, it's important that you put your head in front of the guy.
Yep.
Drive your shoulder into him and pull his legs out from under him and drive him down to the ground. If you don't put your head in front, it'll be an arm tackle, and he might go through and score.
Yep.
So I'm going to stop him. And so I'm focusing on what Coach Small always told me to focus on, and that was the belly button. You can juke your head. You can juke your shoulders. You can do anything to get by me, but the belly button is going to go where the guy's going to go. So I'm going to focus that belly button, put my head in front, drive my shoulder in there, put that guy down on that ground. Here he comes. Here he comes. Here he comes. I'm focusing on that belly button. I'm looking at that Foley catheter. I'm looking at that penis flapping in the breeze with that Foley catheter. I'm focused. I'm going to take him out. All of a sudden, I stand up, I hit that little plate, those doors open up behind me, he goes right by me at a great rate of speed. He could go all the way. The nurses say, "You missed him, you missed him." I say, "Yeah, I missed him, daggone it, shucks." I'm not going to tackle a naked man. So the man went on to later cause a lot of havoc out on Lincoln Boulevard, involving the LAPD, the Sheriff's Department, and finally the Harbor Patrol, where he was fished out of the Marina Bay, finally, after almost 2 hours of running around out there. And that was and they brought him back, and he'd been in very cold water at the time, and we were interested to see. He came back restrained with blankets on with the paramedics, and we being me and the nurses, were very interested to see, is the Foley catheter still in place after he'd been out there doing all this? We pull that cover back. The Foley catheter is still in place. But that water must have really been cold, because they nicknamed him the Peanut
And you can find all of this on YouTube.
It's there. It's there. Wow. Naked man escapes from Marina Hospital. Yeah, you can see the pictures. It's there.
Well, very good. Thanks for sharing that, Dr. Bob. So now with Providence and some of your current work, there's been a lot of talk in the world the last couple of years in emergency medicine about fast tracking, and you know, the word throughput can come up as well. I'm both at ED as well as the main hospital units. Can you tell us what are ED physicians being trained on lately, or what's some hot topics in regards to care coordination, care transitions, trying to keep people out from being admitted? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it's the basis of all the problems that are starting to happen all over the United States are the fact that our system is being overwhelmed. The baby boomers, who are going to go from, I think, 36 million right now in the United States over the next 20 years to somewhere estimated around 78 to 80 million, are overwhelming the hospitals. It's a tsunami of sick people that are coming in. 90% of the Medicare expenses go to people the last 2 years of their life, or last year or two of their life, and it's always people over 65. That's where the cost is. That's where the sick people are. And so in the ER now, we have this overwhelming tsunami of sick people mixed in with people who have lacerations, ankle sprains, all kinds of things. A lot of these minor illness things have been diffused by doc-in-the-boxes or urgent care centers, but we still have just tons of people coming in. ER doctors are held to metrics. We need, and this is both national standards with JCO and CMS and often tied to compensation, what is your door-to-doctor time? When you show up at the door of the ER, how long do you see the doctor? The standard of the industry is they must be seen by a provider, not necessarily a doctor, but someone certified to do an examination that's not a nurse. That can be a nurse practitioner or a physician in general, within 30 minutes. And if you fall below that metric, then it can now begin to have financial consequence for the hospital and certainly to the ER group. That's our mission, is to meet that standard. And it's important. These people that are sitting out there in the waiting room, if they're not seen immediately, the elderly gentleman with what seems to be back sprain or back pain could have an abdominal aneurysm. His life is threatened. So a lot of the what looks like little symptoms can be signs of really serious illness, so we have to get to them quickly. That's one challenge. The other challenge is finding room for them and finding beds.
Yeah.
We're overwhelmed. We're having to board people in the ER because the hospital is overwhelmed with sick people that they can't get out of the hospital. So it's kind of like the faucet is turning on, flooding us with no exit for the patients, and that's causing us to have to hold people. Ambulances keep coming. They keep coming, and we have no place to put patients. Literally, they're in the hallways. They're in chairs. They're all over the place. And this is happening in all ERs all over the United States. It's not unique to Providence. Providence has a very little company, and Torrance has a very proactive approach to this. They go out. They see people immediately. They switch beds around. They have a discharge planners involved in the patients coming in the minute they hit the door. So when you're admitted with pneumonia, we're planning on your discharge 3 days later. We're already making arrangements for that. And that's really what hospitals are going to have to do now. They've got to be proactive in what is going to be the total experience for this patient, not just the admission. And then, gee, is mom going to go home today or tomorrow? We got to know that ahead of time and coordinate all the studies, all the tests, all the therapies and stuff to meet those standards.
So the whole word throughput, how does that impact emergency medicine? You mentioned, for example, hospitals may not have beds available for patients to admit to because they maybe aren't being discharged for whatever reason. Tell us about some throughput challenges that you see and maybe some solutions that you think folks can lean on.
Well, I think they're rethinking the entire process right now. So as I said, when you're admitted, the plan is to make a disposition on that patient and do it in a timely manner after admission and to clear those beds out. Hospitals are kind of like hotels. And CMS, the people that, this is the Centers for Medicaid
services
who control those patients' payments, have been very strict about certain diagnoses meeting certain time frames. For example, pneumonia. If you're admitted with a community-acquired pneumonia, you must be taken care of and sent out of the hospital in 3 days, three midnights, they say. And if you don't meet that standard, then the hospital then loses money on the patient. So the checkout time for that patient is 11 a.m., just like a hotel. Yeah. So if that patient is lying there on the third day and stays until 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock, not only can you not use that bed for another admission, but you now, the hospital now, is financially going to have to eat that and just pay for that themselves and lose money in the process. And as you know, you cannot charge the patient independent of Medicare. Mm-hmm. When they are Medicare, you cannot charge them supplemental charges for staying there later. So the hospitals have to have financial consequences for that, and that really affects the bottom line of being able to provide care. You can't lose money in the process. It's like any other business.
So it's kind of like a hotel. One of their guests doesn't leave their room. They can't rent it out, or they can't get another person in
exactly.
there, so they eat the cost.
Exactly.
So has Providence, or have you heard of any health systems or hospitals come up with solutions to get these patients out of the bed and into their homes?
Well, I know for a fact that your company, that I think very highly of, 24-Hour Home Care, has been proactive in helping discharge planners and people plan that, gee, we can send your patient home with a provider to make sure that they have a safe home, that they get their medications, that they get to their doctor visits, that they have hygiene taken care of, nutrition taken care of, and take their medications. The number one cause of failure in these patients when they're sent home, and elderly patients in particular, of them not getting well, getting sick, or having to be readmitted, is that they're not taking their medicines and not following up with their doctor. So these things are critical. And I think anybody out there in the audience who's had an elderly relative in a different area, a different state, a different city or something, who has something happen, and there's no family immediately available there, and, gee, mom has to go home now, but we're worried about her being home alone, mm-hmm. this becomes a nightmare. What are we going to do? How are we going to make sure she's taken care of? And I think people, the other assumption is, and this is very disappointing to people's families when I'm in the ER and tell them this, is, well, we'll just put daddy in a nursing home and Medicare will pay for it.
Yeah.
And I tell the nurses, listen, let's go get a cup of water for this gentleman before I talk to him. Sir, why don't you have a seat here in the chair? I'm going to tell you about the situation with nursing homes. And the answer is Medicare does not pay for nursing. Medicare will pay for transition care from people who are sick for up to 30 days when they're sent to what's called a step-down unit. And that's actually a minority of patients. A large number of them just need somebody to help take care of them, somebody to make sure they get their medicines and stuff. And the solution to most people is, we'll go to the nursing home. Once they figure out that, gee, sending that granny to a nursing home, if you want the good one, mm-hmm. with the little buses, the little activities, and the chef on in place, and a little room for her all by herself, you can send your kid to Princeton for less money than that's going to cost you.
Yeah.
That's going to cost you upwards of $200,000 a year for a good one, $100,000 for a mediocre nursing home, $100,000 a year not paid for. And unless people have insurance for that, and very few do,
yeah.
It becomes a financial catastrophe for the families.
I know that some folks have talked about, well, you know, let's just send her to a Medicaid or Medi-Cal nursing home, a convalescent home. What's the difference between like a long-term convalescent home that maybe Medi-Cal pays for versus like a transitional care center?
Well, I'm not as experienced to know all the details of that, but I do know this. People qualifying for Medi-Cal care long-term are very few, and they have to have very strict criterion for that to happen. They have to be disabled. They have to meet certain criteria, and they can't care for themselves and so on and so forth. It's not going to be your elderly patient who just needs some help at home. That's not going to happen. And as all government bureaucracies, the convolutions in getting that done for people takes time, months often, or longer. And even then, it's on a first-come, first-served basis. They only have so much money. So that's really not an answer. People would love to think it is, but it's really, in my experience, it doesn't work. Just doesn't work.
Yeah, so going back to the transitional care patients who may transition to skilled nursing facility for that transitional care, maybe some therapy, What do you look for in the nursing homes that maybe you've worked with in the past, or maybe any other post-acute providers that you've referred people to? What do you look for in those type of providers?
You know, the transitional care units are a lot of times contracted by the hospital or owned by the hospital. In the case of Providence, that is the case. They have a transitional care. It's an outstanding facility, but they only have a limited number of beds. So, first off, the patients have to meet the criterion, which is 3 days in the hospital. If they're only there 2 days, they don't qualify. And they have to have certain diagnoses, for example, recovery from a stroke or recovery from a hip operation where there's a defined rehab situation where they're trying to get them back into their homes and get them well. Meeting those criteria, then they can go to these places, and they do a lot of good. But that doesn't apply to many, many, many of these patients. They don't meet the criterion, and that's the great loss out there. That's where we don't have a good answer. And I think things like 24-hour home care can fill that void. That's where you need somebody you can trust to come in there and make sure that your relative, your patient, is going to get the amount of care and the kind of care that they need to keep them from having coming back to the hospital or getting sicker. That's what it's all about.
So when these patients are given instructions maybe to go home or go to a nursing home for a rehab, they don't always follow instructions, as you know. Non-compliance sometimes is an issue. What tips do you have to help patients be compliant? What type of support or what methods do you think can help with compliance issues?
You know, that is a constant source of conflict in the ER. We have very elaborate computer programs that will print out pages of information about what you should do after you go home, very specific to the complaint. You've hurt your ankle. Here's literally 15 pages on how to take care of your ankle, elevate it, ice it, so on and so forth and so on. It's now been shown in study after study that people over the age of 65 have about a 60% illiteracy rate. And that doesn't mean necessarily that they can't read. It just means that they haven't been reading enough, or they have some degree of dementia or lack of attention or visual problems, something that they cannot absorb what you put on that paper. How many people out there in your audience actually, when they leave the ER, even if they can read and they're 20 or 30 years old, handed the 15 pages on their ankle sprain, read it?
No one does. Still in the car.
Yeah. No one does. It's in the bottom of the bird cage or in the trash. You may find it when you clean out your trunk 3 years later. But no, it has not been read. It's not read. It's a CYA situation where we're giving them something to make them think that we're doing this. So what we tell the ER doctors, number one, if the old boy is there with his wife, talk to her. He isn't going to remember anything that's said in here. The commander-in-chief, the wife of 30 years, is going to write down three things. Number one, what we think is wrong with you. Number two, what the plan is to do about it. You're going to take this medicine, you're going to do these three things. And number three, this is what you're going to do for follow-up. If you can get those three things across to them, and that's all we can hope for, then you stand a chance of actually having a good outcome with a patient. Handing them papers does nothing. Compliance is zero. It's been shown in a lot of ERs that somewhere around 25% of the prescriptions written are never filled.
Wow.
And that's young people, old people, all people. You give them the prescription, they don't bother to fill it. So not only are they not doing what you say, they're not even taking the medication.
Yeah. Well, I know also with medication, nutrition in a similar way plays a huge role in preventing readmissions and making sure people don't come back. You know, personally, I've met with some of our clients and they've been eating the same TV dinners for the last 30 years. And, you know, we wonder why they're having health issues. So can you give any tips about nutrition or share some things with our audience about that?
Well, as you are aware, I wrote a book called The Battle Buddy Diet. And I would encourage all of your audience out there to watch a fabulous medical documentary called Forks Over Knives. Forks meaning you eat with forks, over knives meaning knives that cut you open. Forks Over Knives is available on Netflix. To me, it's the most profound medical documentary in the history of medicine. It shows unequivocally that diet and what you eat has everything to do with your health. Everything to do with it. A non-inflammatory diet protects you against disease. A Western diet, which is an inflammatory diet, causes disease. And Ryan, you make a very good point. Many of these old people are nutritionally absolutely in the dumps, because I've met old men who live alone, for example, and the guy eats oatmeal every meal because he makes a little instant oatmeal, and that's what he eats every meal, and that's what he's comfortable with. He buys big stores of oatmeal and eats it, doesn't eat anything else, and we wonder why he's getting sick.
Yeah.
So that's a huge thing. Also, we know that diet, if you start out early in life and you eat the right foods, do a little exercise, get 8 hours of sleep a night, and laugh once or twice a day, and exercise being key, you're going to avoid dementia, you're going to stay functional into older age, and you're not going to be tethered to the medical system, taking 15 medicines, having multiple operations, and having a horrible, miserable life. We know that. So that's really preventative. That's what it's all about. The word is finally starting to get out there that you really need to watch what you eat. So I would encourage people to take a look at the book. It's on Amazon, thebattlebuddydiet.com. It's how you do it as a couple. I sincerely believe I do more good with that book than I ever do in the ER, where I offer no cure. I can only offer palliative care, hopefully relieve a little bit of suffering and misery of these sick, sick people who've got irreversible disease and just are miserable. I mean, it's very disheartening to watch that.
So if you can sum up the book, Battle Buddy Diet, how could you sum it up to our audience who might be interested?
There's a little known fact out there that men necessarily don't want to hear, but I'm going to let you hear it anyway, and that is this.
Uh-oh.
Men over the age of 55, and I know you're single, Ryan, men over the age of 55 who are married live 16 to 18 years longer than single men over the age of 55.
And, good to know.
Yeah, women love to tell you, it's because they're so happy. not exactly. It's because she is going to nag the big dummy into taking care of his health. You'll also notice these guys over 55 that are married have trimmed eyebrows and no hair coming out of their ears because she's done taking care of that too. But she's going to nag him to go into the doctor, get the colonoscopy, do what you're supposed to do, and take care of their health. Absolutely. So the Battle Buddy Diet is actually my experience with my wife, who's a cardiac anesthesiologist, and our coming of age and learning about nutrition and deciding that, you know what, we need to do this as a couple. If we do this as a couple, that is, put the right foods in the house and eat the right food, we can change our lives and we can increase our energy level, our longevity, and we can be healthier. And that's exactly what we found. So it's really a diet about whole foods. If it grows in the ground, you can eat it. I haven't found any Dorito trees or Cheeto trees. I'm looking for them. Haven't found one yet. But if you eat that and fish and then do those exercise and sleep, you will live forever. And the book is about how you do it as a couple. And I invite people to go on Amazon and look at a sample and see what they think. But it changed our lives, and I've gotten a lot of feedback from people who have done it too, that it's actually changed your life. And then you won't be in the ER with your diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, strokes, cancer. All those things are driven by diet.
Dr. Bob, I really like what you had to say about having a partner with nutrition, whether it's nutrition
or... Being married, Gavin, I understand that.
Well, likewise, and Ryan, maybe one day as well, you'll have that as well. But Ryan's actually very good as a single man. He's actually one of the healthiest people that I've ever worked with, and actually has inspired me to eat a little healthier. But we are actually running out of time on our podcast, Dr. Bob, and just wanted to thank you again so much for being a guest. And again, if you want to learn more about Dr. Bob and some of the work that he's done, you can find him on YouTube under Funny ER Doctor. Again, his best-selling book, The Battle Buddy Diet, is available as well. And lastly, the word of the day. We have not mentioned the word of the day yet. And the first five people to respond with the word of the day will be entered into a raffle for a Pop Health Podcast t-shirt. When you do submit your words, please also submit your t-shirt size. The word of the day is diet. The word of the day is diet. And Dr. Bob, we have about a minute left, maybe like 30 seconds to 60 seconds. Can you tell us what your biggest takeaway would be for the audience today?
I think that people prophylactically taking care of their health is really the key. And those parents out there, if you can do anything for your kids, keep them away from the fast food, the sugar, and all that stuff. Read about it. Learn about it. It is really what it's all about.
Thanks, Dr. Bob, for the takeaway. Ryan Iwamoto has been my co-host. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
And look forward to having our next guest on the podcast soon as well. Thanks, everybody. Take care.